Got it. There we go. I gotta click. Got it. All right.
Hi, this is Barry, and welcome to the Simplicity Zen podcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you could take a moment to like and subscribe, and I guess there's a little alert button there. If you're watching on one of the podcast apps, you can subscribe through the podcast app, and you can also go to simplicityzen.com and sign up for our mailing list there. Today, my guest is David Chadwick. He's a longtime Zen practitioner and studied with Suzuki Roshi at Tassajara and San Francisco Zen Center, starting in 1966. He was ordained by Suzuki in 1971. He's the author of two wonderful books about Zen Buddhism, the first being Thank You and Okay, an American Zen Failure in Japan. And the second is Crooked Cucumber, the Life and Zen Teachings of Shinryu Suzuki. Thanks for being here today with us, David.
Hey, my pleasure.
Yeah. So you're in Bali, is that right?
Yeah.
Is this where you've retired to, or is this where you live now?
Yeah, well, retired doesn't mean anything to me. But it's where I live.
Yeah.
Yeah, we moved here 9 years ago. In December, it'll be 9 years. And I haven't been back to Cuckoo Land.
Have not.
And my wife goes every year to see grandkids and stuff like that.
Have you started a sitting group out there or anything like that?
No, I just sit. Yeah. I've done Vipassana retreats. Mako Vohil is visiting us now, and she's going to be the new city center abbot in San Francisco in March. She's really she's like a backpacker. I mean, she really is adaptable. And right after she got here, I told her about this Balinese Chinese healer, Vipassana trained guy who has really interesting retreats. She said, "Oh, I'll do one if I can." So I got hold of him. He said, "We got one starting in 2 days. It's full, but I'll get her in." And they gave her a discount.
Great.
And so she's there for a week retreat. Beautiful place, in the country. So I've done those retreats too, called Bali Usada. I have constant contact with people. I have enough sangha. But I just sit. I sit by myself in the mornings. And Katrinka sits too. We don't sit together.
That's your wife.
Yeah. And I told Maka when she got here, just do your own schedule, you know. So now I have a husband and wife friend here that are with Richard Baker's group in Germany. Well, the husband got killed in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, wow.
Which happens here and everywhere. But they sat Zazen together, did Orioki breakfast together and stuff like that. And it worked for them. But that wouldn't work for us.
Right. Yeah. My wife doesn't want to sit with me either. where did you grow up?
Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay. So that was probably pretty all American conservative upbringing.
Not my family.
Not your family?
No. Maybe politically sort of conservative, but socially and spiritually fantastic. Socially growing and open, couldn't speak disrespectfully about anybody in our home. And my father, especially, he was a realtor. He said, the only good business deal is one where both parties profit. And he was And his he was really into like mind only sort of cosmic consciousness
stuff.
Yeah. And sort of what I call the precursors to the New Age. Mm-hmm. And but the sort of Christianity that's called New Thought Christianity, it's not really known now. It was bigger mm-hmm. in America in the earlier parts of the 20th century, like mm-hmm. Church of Religious Science, mm-hmm. Christian Science came out of it, Unity. Mm-hmm.
Was there a community there like that that you guys went to?
No.
So he just found this from books or whatever.
Yeah, we had one friend who shared that sort of thing. So, I mean, our form, we did a lot of reading of the Gospels, but the interpretation of it was totally non-theistic sort of nature of mind mm-hmm. stuff. You know, we just sort of regarded other people as being superstitious and having, you know, what I call action figure religion. Like Jesus is a little action figure and God's an action figure.
Would you consider your dad, do you think he was a mystic of some sort? Or is it philosophical for him?
He was, you know, that stuff is very rooted in healing and mm-hmm. health and sort of like knowing it's like all problems come from erring thought and all that. There wasn't any meditation or practice, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I had a good grounding in that sort of thing. And also, he died when I was young. And, you know, I just felt like he was continuing and he was on a good path. And
would you say young? Were you a child or a teenager? Or
11, 12, 11. Mm-hmm. I was 11, I think. Mm-hmm. When I ran into the San Francisco Zen Center, Katagiri Suzuki, I went, ah, yeah, this is good. LSD, mm-hmm. pot first, and then LSD and mescaline and all that. Which I didn't take a ton of, but enough to go, ooh, yeah, this mm-hmm. is what they're talking about.
Was your mom into that spiritual
stuff
as well?
Uh-huh. Yeah. She wasn't like, he was, you know, she had a different approach. He turned her on to it, mm-hmm. you know. She grew up in a German Texas family that said, you know, that was atheistic and like, so she was afraid of death, mm-hmm. Just thought when you die, you just go into the ground and everything goes dark or that's mm-hmm. it. So that was, she didn't, but so he sort of turned her on to another way of looking things, which was very liberating. Also, she didn't know anything about sex, so he helped with that. And she told me she discovered that there was such a thing of what it was at the age of 21 in the Vassar Library. And mm-hmm. she said she was so angry at her parents when she realized that she fell. So anyway, yeah. So I was very fortunate with them. And she was really into, she was involved with the arts and stuff. And she always taught me that homosexuality was normal, might be unusual behavior, but it's normal. And we couldn't my friends and I, we could do anything we wanted. We could cuss, we could drink, we could smoke, mm-hmm. but we couldn't say anything racist, sexist, or homophobic.
Wow.
So that was nice growing up in that home. It was helpful.
What did the wider community think of your parents' liberal?
They didn't know.
They didn't know.
Yeah. No, my mother died at 98 and a half. Mm-hmm. And my only relative that I know of in Texas is the governor. Mm-hmm. She knew him. I remember him when he was a little tiny kid, but they lived in another
place. This is the guy who's in the wheelchair. I forget, Abbott, is that his name?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Greg Abbott.
Yeah.
You know, she'd go when he was Chief Justice, she'd go down to Austin and to a dinner for him. She'd say, David says hello. And he'd say, isn't he a Democrat? And you know, he's super right winger. Then he became governor. She went down for that. But he and I have no contact. And we never, I knew his mother. I liked his mother. I knew his aunt and uncle.
He's your
second cousin.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Yeah. And then did you have brothers and sisters?
I have a sister in Oakland.
Yeah. And so did you do sports? I mean, you seem a very.
Tennis.
Yeah. You seem a very outgoing, gregarious person. I imagine you had a lot of friends in high school and were social. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got along with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I always made a point of was get along with the dangerous people, the hoods. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be too close. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just treat people with respect, just say hello, stuff mm-hmm. like that. That helped me at times because I was really wild, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember being out, just being told crazy, drunk, and these people from another high school, these guys wanted to beat me up, and then the hoods came over and wouldn't let them.
Mm-hmm. So when your father passed away, did you process that at the time?
I missed him. I was very sad, but like I said, I felt like he had moved on and was mm-hmm. continuing his spiritual path. Mm-hmm. Never have I been to his grave. Mm-hmm. There was never any discussion of it. That mm-hmm. was like irrelevant, you know, had nothing to do with him. It was just some cultural thing they did. And with my mother, she was cremated in a cardboard box, and I've got her ashes in storage in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And that also means almost nothing to me. I'm really bad on symbolic stuff. But I think, well, it would be nice to go back. And my first wife was very close to mother, mm-hmm. and my present wife, my fourth wife, and my sister. My sister's even more like me, like the ashes mean nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. But I know it would be nice for all of us to go to Tassajara and spread her ashes there, because mm-hmm. we all like Tassajara.
Did she ever visit there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 So
I asked Lou Harrison, the classical composer who had a Chinese little ensemble, mm-hmm. If he'd like to come be there at the same time she was, so they could meet, because she'd composed some classical music, and she was 50 years on the opera board in Fort Worth.
Oh, wow.
And the opera, Fort Worth Opera, did her funeral during the opera season. She's nice.
So it sounds like maybe she was you got your gregarious friendly genes from her.
She was very quiet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Nobody knew she was voting Democratic. Nobody knew she was voting. She had friends that were outspoken. But no, but she never would say anything that might upset anybody, or she didn't express opinions, but we knew at home how she felt.
So did you go to college?
A little bit. I didn't want to. I already knew in high school that I was just going to head out. I didn't know why. But she begged me, because we had enough money, you know. She begged me, just try. So I went to this little church school that was pretty highly rated near Fort Worth, near Dallas. And I lasted 3/4 of a year, and they told me I could never come back. And then the next year, see, that was 64. Then I got involved with a little civil rights work in Mississippi and SDS, Student for a Democratic Society, and living in New Orleans. And then I went to Mexico and discovered the wonders of marijuana, and went to the Mexico City College. Is that what we were calling it then? It's the University of the Americas, or I can't remember what it's called. I went there for 2/4, and they told me I could never come back.
Was this academically, or you partied, or what was the transgression?
Oh, I didn't do anything at the Austin College. I was living at the school. I did stuff to upset them. pardon me, I'm just remembering some things. The college in Mexico, it's a little outside Mexico City, it's still going. I did anything there to upset them. I wasn't making good grades. I wasn't paying much attention. And I wasn't living in approved housing. And my landlord told him they'd see me smoking marijuana. Yerba del Caballo. That's my college. But then, you know, later on, I had the equivalent of a college education.
So you were doing civil rights work in the South.
Yeah.
How did you make your way to the Bay Area? Or did you go there specifically?
After I was in Mexico City, I stayed on there, and I went to South America for the summer. That was great. And then, you know, I was just hanging out with hippie people, and they say, hey, it's all happening in San Francisco. In 66, I went there and joined some of them. And that was great. The hate was just getting going. And then because of an LSD experience, I'd take LSD very seriously, like meditate, no talking, fast beforehand. And I didn't take it a lot. Then I decided I've got to find a guru or meditate with a group. And so that led to the Zen Center.
That
did it.
The LSD experience, can you describe that a little bit? Like what about it kind of opened you up?
Well, I followed, I used the Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, Ralph Metzner book, The Psychedelic Experience, which was a guidebook oriented toward getting you to have an experience of the clear light. So I did have an experience of the clear light, and I really felt afterwards, that's great. That's the ultimate. But obviously, you can only visit it with acid. So I had a sense that you've got to have some sort of practice that's constant or, you know, continual in order to really, become closer to it, one with it, whatever.
Did you have any experiences that you would characterize as oneness or no self?
Oh,
or
sure.
Ego death?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Did that correlate with the, what do you call it, the clear light? Or were those separate?
Well, ego death can happen way before clear light. Mm-hmm. And selflessness, yeah, there's a whole infinite variety of experiences mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. there.
Do you think clear light was maybe the equivalent of what Mahayana Buddhists would consider like luminous mirror mind or luminous mirror wisdom?
I don't feel qualified to comment on that. I stay away from stuff like that. I don't try to acquaint psychedelic experience with spiritual experience. I think, you know, it's like Kobenshino took acid in
I didn't know that.
67. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he was having an affair with a woman who turned him on, and which did not last long. But he said, he told me it was spiritual masturbation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think in terms of the experience in 1964, I've mm-hmm. got a 12-part series on Qube.com called Freedom Songs, mm-hmm. My Journey Through 1964. Mm-hmm. And it tells about the whole thing. And if I can get to it, I plan to make it into a book and an audio book. Mm-hmm. I've also got a maybe 6-part series on living in Mexico and going to South America. Hmm. I got a 4-part on a psychic that was very strong psychic that I met in 66 mm-hmm. and, you know, continued to know into his 90s. Mm-hmm. Fred Kimball. So those mm-hmm. are all, I got tons of stuff I've written on Qube.com. Mm-hmm.
I've gotten lost there for hours many times.
The
interviews are great.
Yeah, and I'm still doing them. I've branched out somewhat, and that's great. You know, one thing, I just read that piece by, I don't know, he's got like a Czechoslovakian name on how Zen is dying in Japan.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. Zillion people. It's everywhere. You know, it's a couple of years old. Mako asked if I'd ever read it. I said, no, but I know what he's talking about. But I read it. It was very well done. Mm-hmm. And the same thing sort of happening in America. It's like the people, the baby boomers created. Well, there was this D.T. Suzuki, Alan Watson boom with the Beats, mm. and that was sort of intellectual. And then the practice Zen boom that started in the 60s and 70s. And then, you know, there's all these groups, but they don't tend to be attracting a lot of young people. And but that doesn't discourage me. I've done like, you know, like over 100 podcasts with mm-hmm. basically Zen people, basically mm-hmm. people from the San Francisco, mainly people who were around in the Suzuki days, mm-hmm. Shunryu Suzuki days, but others, you know, and that almost all of them are meditating and have very admirable spiritual practices, and some of them people had no idea. I think things just might take different forms, and they want, you know, a lot of people don't want aren't really interested in being involved with the more formal structured wearing robes and mm-hmm. doing chants in Japanese. I like doing that. Mm-hmm. Doesn't bother me. But I did stop wearing robes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a
85.
Do you have a Karomo in Bali?
What?
Do you have a Karomo down there with you in Bali?
No. I have a Raktu. I wear a Raktu. And I had a sitting robe made. Mm-hmm. Bali Usada, that Balinese group, that, you know, they charge for a retreat. They charge, you know, like right now the price has gone up about $400 for a week retreat. Mm-hmm. But I can go free. And I think it really helps that I have a robe and rock too. Mm-hmm. And I went to a retreat there, and then I went to the group picture, and the teacher told me, "Hey, go get that robe on that thing you wear." Yeah, and I like sitting in robes better. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, I've noticed. I try to pay attention to the wider Zen scene, and I've noticed that younger people, they're a little bit more attracted to the kind of the more intense, more traditional Rinzai stuff, it seems, these days.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's because there's more young people there to start with, so they want to, you know, you go to a group and you see a bunch of people older than you, maybe you don't feel connected it, or you go to another group, it is more young people, and you're like, oh, okay, I guess this is my people. You know, maybe it's just that. I don't know. Or maybe they want the intense traditional training. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in that subject, and I'm not sure at all what's happening. But I talk to people a lot, but mm-hmm. I'm not there. But like, I lived with John Tarrant. Mm-hmm. You know who he is, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Pacific Zen Institute. I lived with him for about 8 years. He had a big estate, and I lived in his barn. Mm-hmm. And I'd sit with his group, like, mm-hmm. you know, quite a bit. I wasn't really a member of the group. I was just mm-hmm. a friend of the group. They get a lot of people. They keep getting young people. Mm-hmm. And his approach, and it's not just him, it's other teachers from his lineage. Mm-hmm. Their approach is has very little of the Japanese baggage. Mm-hmm. I like being in Japan. I speak enough Japanese to, you know, mm-hmm. converse with people, and mm-hmm. I like practicing there. And I was at Aheiji with Katrinka, what was that? It was about 8.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a totally different experience. They were very friendly. They met me with a new book. You know, I had two books of vignettes on Suzuki Roshi. Zen is Right Here, and then Zen is Right Now. Mm-hmm. And Zen is Right Here had just come out in Japanese.
Embarrassingly, I didn't realize I own those books and forgot yeah. that you were involved with them.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They totally did them.
Yeah. Totally forgot. I'm sorry.
Michael Katz helped me a lot with Zen is Right Here. He's mm-hmm. the guy who was, I call him my co-conspirator. Mm-hmm. And he's the one in Nevada City I mentioned. Mm-hmm. A lot of people helped me choose the vignettes. You know, I put about, I think it has 125 vignettes. Maybe mm-hmm. I got 250 vignettes together. Mm-hmm. And we voted on them. Mm-hmm. Michael, me, Thomas Moore, you know, wrote Care of the Soul. Mm-hmm. He's been really close with us. A lot of people, Tygan, Dan Layton, I've always stayed close to time. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so we picked those. And yeah, it was originally called To Shine One Corner of the World, and it's right here. It was Penguin Random House or whatever. It was Broadway, part of Random House. Mm-hmm. And it went out of print. I didn't do anything to promote it, which I did with Crooked Cucumber, because mm-hmm. I was having a love affair and was crazy and just couldn't function very well. Yeah, I was between wives, and so that was nice. Incidentally, my wife, this is also her fourth marriage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's enough. There's no more.
This is it.
Yeah, I liked them all. We're all close. Mm-hmm. One of them died, but no more of that. Too much drama, and it's distracting. You know, it's not just being married.
Yeah,
having it be steady. Anyway, then Sam Burkholz picked up both books, Thank You and Okay, which was Penguin, and To Shine One Corner of the World. And they wanted to change the name, so we were forced to call it Zen Is Right Here, because that's one of the names we submitted. And
Do you remember, so you're living in San Francisco, do you remember... So you probably had awareness of Zen through like D.T. Suzuki and Alan Watts, maybe Christmas Hunt from Vries, kind of that. Is that kind of how you were introduced to Zen itself? Do you remember?
I think Charles Nunn came up to me in a hall in Pascal High School in Fort Worth and showed me Zen Flesh, Zen Bones.
Okay.
And it was like, to him, it was like this great discovery, you know, look at this. In Mexico, I read Buddha's Law Among the Birds, which Edward Conze had translated from a Tibetan text.
Never heard of that.
Oh, it's very cool. Then I read Wang Po. And that's okay. Before I came to Zen Center.
The one
that
with the black and
great
blue
book.
The one with the black and blue bird on the cover.
Well, I don't remember the cover.
It's probably
and that's probably a new cover. Mm-hmm. That's Blowfields,
right?
Wang Po.
Yeah,
absolutely great book. I mean, Wang Po said, all you have to do is stand when you're standing, sit when you're sitting, walk when you're walking. Do that for 10 years and that should do it, you know. And I've never gotten beyond that.
Yeah. So you had these kind of mind-blowing experiences on LSD. You had a sense you wanted to have some sort of guru or guidance, you know, formal practice. Was San Francisco's
but also I had the grounding I got at home growing up. And
right.
That was really something. And it's rare. I know, because of the number of people I've interviewed and mm-hmm. everything. It's rare to have come from a spiritual background that you mm-hmm. don't reject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, true. I mean, I reject elements of it or something, but I do that with everything. Yeah. And I did read D.C. Suzuki. I've read it, but it didn't do much. I mean, it's interesting. I read Alan Watts. Yeah, he's really good. Both of them familiarized me more. I got somewhat familiar with what Zen was and Buddhism. But they weren't inspiring. What worked for me was just going to Zen Center and seeing people meditated together. Mm-hmm. I had the little bit of a barrier because they were bowing down to the floor.
Mm-hmm. did you try any other traditions first, or was Zen kind of
I did look around. I wasn't attracted to anything mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. And also, once I started doing that, I really wasn't interested in shopping around. I didn't mind meeting other teachers or groups or something. But, you know, people, a lot of people tended to say, well, to be very sort of like going to a rival high school, you know. Mm-hmm. I had that experience at Sasaki's group. Read the part on Cuke.com about Sasaki, though. Okay. And I've got an interview with him there I did in 69. Mm-hmm. We just showed up there, a friend of mine and I, my sister, and said, he kicked me out first time I went, mm-hmm. you know, calling Tassara plays in, get out of here. Mm-hmm. But then I went in 69 and he was very friendly and open and I said he appreciated what we were doing. Mm-hmm. I said, we want to interview you for the Wind Belt. I just made it up, mm-hmm. you know? And we had a great time with him. He said great things. I loved it. And I did submit it to the Wind Belt. They didn't use it. They should have. But, you know, they're sort of in-house stuff. Still right. That way, pretty much. Unless it's something to do with diversity, or they do a lot of PC stuff now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So do you? So when you first went to Zen Center, was it at Sokoji or was it? Or did they have Page Street?
No, that was 69. I went in 66.
Oh, so Page Street wasn't until 69. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, November.
Oh yeah, Tassahar was before Page Street.
Huh. Yeah, 67.
Yeah. Okay. I never really fully grokked that. I don't think.
Yeah, yeah, I arrived at Zen Center, and you know, after I'd been there like a month or so, mm-hmm. all of a sudden they're talking about Tassahara being, I'd heard about it, becoming a reality. And I'm working on a book that I have to finish it. I did podcasts. I read the whole thing. I've got over 100 pieces written. Now I'm going to work on it to make a real book called Tassahara Stories. Mm-hmm. And it elaborates much more than Crooked Cucumber on the beginnings and Tassahara. And a lot of crazy stories and, you know, I mean, I tend to gravitate toward things that are interesting. Mm-hmm. And there'll be some Dharma in there. I'm going to call it Tassahara Stories, The Early Years with Shunyu Suzuki. I moved to Tassahara very early, like mm-hmm. March of 67. And we bought it at the very end of December of 66.
So when you went to Sokoji, did you walked in, you saw a bunch of hippies meditating. I mean, did you meet Suzuki right away?
No, he was in Japan.
Okay.
I think I was there for 2 weeks, but I like Katagiri. You know, he's the one I met.
And, oh, he was there.
And yeah, also guru fixated. Mm-hmm. I never was. I mean, Suzuki was my teacher and I thought he was great and all that, but I knew it was just up to me, you know, mm-hmm. You can't. But anyway, yeah, I like kind of mainly it was just going and sitting. Mm-hmm. Once I started sitting there, I was sitting twice a day, morning and afternoon, like every day.
So it just intuitively felt right.
Yeah, I thought, oh, this is good. I'll do it for a year mm-hmm. without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So I won't. I'll give it a year without judging it. And then we'll see. And I, you know, never thought about it again. I liked it. Mm-hmm. I liked it with Richard Baker. It wasn't, you know, it. When Suzuki was there, it was really great, but it was much more dynamic with Richard Baker. Mm-hmm. A lot more happening, a lot more access to him, but a lot more people stayed. It was very hard to see Suzuki. You know, he was sick a lot, mm-hmm. He really just wanted to everybody to sit together and work. And he gave lectures. He told me he'd just soon not give lectures. We'd just sit and work. And, it was sort of like nothing special Zen, right? Dick was like really dynamic. It was always interesting. And I call that the imperial era, you know?
When is this after Suzuki passed away or?
Dick was in Japan.
Yeah.
He came back before Suzuki died.
So when you showed up, Baker was in Japan. You hadn't met him yet.
Yeah, he went to Suzuki sent him to Japan. He went in October of 68, and he came back in like October of 71.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and he was enjoying it in Japan. He didn't want to come back. He didn't want to be happy. He didn't want to do that. But Suzuki was dying, and he had to. Mm-hmm. And I've got a very interesting podcast with a really interesting guy. It was the first one I did that had nothing to do with Zen Center, I thought. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. Oh, God. Mm-hmm. I know him very well. Anyway, he lives in India now. I knew him in Japan. And he knew Dick in Japan. He said he was just the coolest guy in the world, like a bohemian Zen guy and everything. Everything was really cool. Then he visited him at Green Gulch later. And he said, "What? You're becoming Episcopalian. What's this?" David Kubiak is his name. Very interesting guy. One of the few things I would like to do is go to Rajasthan and see him. He's in his mid 80s now. Lived many years in Japan and India. And I visited him once in Santa Cruz. He was tied in with this real hip group in Santa Cruz. Anyway, all right. Enough of that.
Do you remember any particular personalities that stood out to you in the early years when you first started showing up? Was Rev Anderson around?
Oh, he came in 68.
68, okay.
Yeah. And he was coming to visit his old friend mm-hmm. who he grew up with, Bob Halpern, mm-hmm. who was my best friend and mm-hmm. totally outrageous guy, mm-hmm. right? And Suzuki wanted to do our Danis together, but both he and Bob agreed. Bob was too mercurial. Mm-hmm. One of my problems with Tazara's story is I could write a whole book on Bob. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bob, I learned a lot from Bob. He was just very spontaneous, and he could see the other side of things and mm-hmm. said a lot of ironic things. And mm-hmm. he could be on the true believing side and then go sort of make fun of it. And anyway, he also had a tendency to fall into unwholesomeness in different ways.
Is he, did he stick around in Zen Center or what?
No, he became drunk with student.
Okay.
And Suzuki really, pretty sure he became like when Trunk was right hand man in many mm-hmm. ways. And, mm-hmm. and finally, he went to Japan and started a school there. He was always a salesman into sales and stuff. But anyway, Reb came to visit Bob. Mm-hmm. And so I met him right away. And what I'd say about Reb is he was an older student than me the day he arrived. Mm-hmm. Because Bob and I were sort of cut-ups, mm-hmm. and I just didn't take things seriously. Reb arrived and he was just single-minded and dedicated, and he was a cool guy too, mm-hmm. but his main thing was practice and persevering and mm-hmm. being copying the teachers mm-hmm. and Yeah, I remember when I got ordained as a priest, he told me, you know, you're going to have to straighten up now, realize you're an example and stuff like that. And
that totally happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, stuff like that. And I wrote something about it maybe for, I don't know when. I said he might as well have been talking to the wall, you know. Yeah. I'm just, this will end soon, I'm thinking.
Did you have physical difficulty sitting like Sesshin and stuff like that? I mean, what?
No.
You had, like, you didn't have like dark nights of the soul of destroyed knees or anything like that?
No, I still sit in lotus.
I
would sit Sesshin's entirely in full lotus. And some people have a hard time. Dick Baker had a very, very hard time. And he came at 61, you know, so but it was very hard for him to adjust to that. It depends on people's bodies. But you know what? After a while, he could just sit all the time. Sort of an unusual, I mean, if you look at how much trouble people have sitting when they start and later, he really adapted to it. I'm just working at Wendy Piercing, you know, is the widow of Robert Piercing, who represented the Art of Motorcycle Man. And she works with us at Cuke Archives. And she's like an editor of the book I'm working on, Tassara Stories. And she wrote a thing, you know, their son was murdered at Zen Center, maybe you don't know.
I do know,
And she wrote like a 99-page piece on it back then in her journal. And I just went over it, and we're going to post it on Cuke.com. It's really interesting. And since it was like a diary, it's like really not diplomatic in many ways, describing Zen Center and things she experienced in people. She describes Dick as, you know, that he'd be sitting for a long time and then he'd stand up immediately. And she said he was just so physically agile. She was really impressed by that. And so that was later. That was 79.
Was it your book where you talked about a bunch of students went and got the brain scan and everyone was kind of similar, but Dick was just off the charts on different, like, alpha. So, I mean, it sounds like he had like a deep practice legitimately.
Yeah. Yeah. And his German group is really strong, and I love them. I love being there. And he's got a number of Dharma heirs there. I mean, he's got the thing in Crestone, Colorado going too. It's not as vibrant. It's still going as the German thing. He's got, you know, a few Dharma heirs, Paul Rosenblum, who was a Suzuki student, very close with him. But Nicole Bodden, who's very young, hey, listen to her podcast, man. It is so cool. She is really good. She's very strong, and she's no rubber stamp of Hare Baker. Yeah. She's really good, and she's young. She's really good. And that German group is going well. I love going there. It's the place I'm most comfortable.
When you heard that he was sick, did it come as a shock, or did people know something was up?
Well, he was always sick. I mean, not always, but he would get these long flus. But they were just flus, right?
Right.
But in 71, when he went to Reed College in Oregon, then he had to leave, and Rep brought him, had to fly back, and he went to the hospital, and he had he had to have his gallbladder removed, I think it is. Yeah, and they discovered cancer, but people weren't told. Mm-hmm. We didn't know. Mm-hmm. But there was sort of, maybe there was a little gossip about it, but they felt like they'd gotten all the cancer, and also gallbladder cancer, according to Mickey Stunker, who was a doctor that was, you know, who was a Zen teacher and, mm-hmm. on the East Coast, who was close with Suzuki, said it's sort of rare. So they thought they'd gotten it all. But, you know, he and Mitsu, his wife, Okutan, mm-hmm. They're older Japanese. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Japan, that was still the days when you got cancer, that's it, you're going to die. They didn't even tell people. They don't still do that. Mm-hmm. They don't tell, they tell the family. Nobody tells the person they have cancer, because that's it. You get cancer, you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And I'd talk to Japanese. I'd say, I know a lot of people that have lived with cancer. What are you talking about? But anyway, I think he and Mitsu might have been sort of fatalistic at that point. Mm-hmm. And he definitely felt he didn't have long to go. He had a great summer at Tassajara. Mm-hmm. But as soon as he left, it was just clear he was something wrong with him. They thought it was hepatitis, but actually mm-hmm. Mickey's the one came to visit and said, "That ain't hepatitis, that's cancer." Because mm-hmm. he said he knew, because he was scratching. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's from a tumor. Mm-hmm. That's hepatitis, you don't get that, he said.
So he didn't live
long then.
So were you guys kind of told at the last minute then?
Well, he was pretty sick. I mean, there was sort of, he'd given a talk that year about, you know, called The Driver. And there's a chapter in Crooked Cucumber called The Driver, where he said, you know, you're in a bus with a driver, and you know, you keep bothering him, and then you're going to have a new driver because that driver will die. Mm-hmm. And then try to be better to your new driver, you know, that sort of thing, right? People went, so there was sort of in the air. Yeah. You know, this idea he might have, I can remember asking him about what to do if he died. I mean, it was just in the air. But then with the hepatitis, it was, you know, still went. Yeah, but then I guess it was October he got all his disciples and close people together mm-hmm. in the city and told him that he had cancer. And thought maybe he'd live another year or two, and he lived two more months. It was pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And so we learned right away at Tassajara. So that was, you know, sort of a shock. Mm-hmm. And then he died. And, you know, it was very devastating to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It wasn't to me. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was just like when my father died. He's just on another trip. I learned a lot from him. I'll miss him. Mm-hmm. But that's life, you know.
I know you've never been kind of guru oriented, but did you see Dick Baker as a teacher right away, or did you have to warm to it? Or
I accepted him as a teacher, but I'm not a good student. Mm-hmm. I'm not a devotional type, mm-hmm. you know. So he and I got along. We always got along, but you know, I was sort of, you know, I'd do what he wanted as well as I could, but I'd do anything I wanted and just try to get away with it.
A lot of expensive Zen practice gone to waste, right?
Right, right, yeah.
That's a quote he gave for you on the back of your Thank You, Noke book.
And Shambhala, when they put it out, they didn't put that on their back.
Oh, they didn't?
They left it. No, you have, seen that. You could It's not on the back of the book. However, if you open it up, there's a bio there that had more, and it says it there on like the back.
I thought it was on the back for some reason. Okay.
It was on the back from the Penguin.
Oh, okay.
On the Penguin.
Okay. Yeah.
And he also said, and this is in Thank You and Okay, because I just finished the audio book, you know. So I went over it four times. Mm-hmm. I read it, and then I went over it three times. He said, because I tell the head monk at this temple I'm at in Kyushu, I say, well, you know what? Suzuki's Dharma said, his successor, about me, and said, you know, you better watch out. He said, what? He said, my practice is to lead people on the road to hell.
So do you, how far away do you think Suzuki was from transmitting Kwong and Mel Weitzman? Do you think he planned to do it?
Well, he'd started, he wanted to finish Kwong.
Yeah. Oh, so he'd started, he wanted, I forgot to that do, part. He had started his transmission.
Oh yeah, he just didn't finish it. Listen, he was, his sins of omission are, you know, because I'm so familiar with it, and I go over it, and I get irritated, you know. I mean, he was just too much, you know. Like, I've got a quote in Crooked Cucumber, I guess, maybe, it's, you know, we don't really have to say anything, we'll know, and that sort of thing. But there's all sorts of stuff he didn't say and didn't do, and it caused trouble later, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. Or did he, you know, and I don't believe he did everything on purpose, mm-hmm. you know? There's a lot of that. He got better when he came to America, but with his family, his kids all resented him for mm-hmm. just being distant and cold, and
I remember one
only
of
caring about Zen and not them. And they said, I said to Hoitsu, I said, well, you know, he's an older Japanese. They're he's a priest. He comes from an earlier time. He said, no, that's not what the others weren't like that. He was worse than them. All my friends had better relationships with their fathers than I did.
I remember in one of your interviews with him, he was saying, like, don't paint my father as a great man because he was not a great man or something like that. Does that ring a bell?
Well, yeah. We had an interesting experience when Hoitsu got me together with guys that had sat with Suzuki during the war.
Mm-hmm. The, what is it? And when Mountain Suzuki, Boys or?
Huh?
The
Takakusa Yamakai, the high mountain grass group.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when he'd say, oh, my father was nothing special, blah, 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 they'd say, well, boy, are you wrong, mm-hmm. you know. They countered him. They said there was nobody like him, you know. This temple was a beacon of light during the war. Sort of like at Zen Center, he didn't really say anything, and he allowed other people to talk and to share what they thought in non-seditious ways. Also, you know, they had to sit Zazen. He sat Zazen with them, and there was a group that kept meeting. Mm-hmm. They kept meeting, and, you know, they were even meeting when he died, mm-hmm. you know. But Hoitsu was his son. So, like, yeah, Brian Victoria called up. You know who Brian Victoria is? He wrote Zen at War. And he's spent his lifetime trying to discredit, Soto, Rinzai Zen, mm-hmm. Japanese Zen, different teachers who supported the war, especially Yasutani, mm-hmm. And Harada Yasutani's teacher. He's mm-hmm. gone after, and he's very, I know Brian, you know, I've visited him in Japan, and I had him go over Crooked Cucumber, everything I wrote about war and mm-hmm. all that, it's mm-hmm. all vetted by him, because I knew if it wasn't, I was going to be attacked by, right? And so I brought him to Sebastopol, where I was living. He gave a talk to John Terence Group, in which he dressed up like a Japanese army soldier giving the Imperial Buddhism talk, you know, where the emperor is above Buddha in Japan and this and that. It was incredible. Brian called up Ohetsu. Look, Dick Baker put in the introduction to the original Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind that Suzuki led a pacifist group in Japan during the war.
What's his name? Someone got really upset about that. What was that?
Brian Victoria.
No, but there was somebody else.
Oh, no, Stuart Lacks.
Yeah, Stuart Lacks. Yeah, he was really upset about that. Yeah.
So, you know, when I'm working on this biography of Suzuki, which I started, you know, actually while I was working on Thank You and Okay, I would take stuff out of Thank You and Okay and go, hey, no, this would be better on a book on Suzuki. So Brian calls up Shimizu and asks about that. And Ohetsu said, my father did nothing during the war. He just, you know, he just like everybody else, he put his head down and went, ah. And when he said that to those guys who were there who were with Suzuki during the war, which Ohetsu wasn't, they said, you are wrong. You know, boy, they read him the riot act on that. And so the thing was, there was no pacifist movement in Japan during the war. That's insane. Now, no way. But, you know, the Japanese are more subtle than Americans, so it's hard to understand. I have a chapter in Crooked Cucumber where I take Suzuki to Berkeley to sit there, and then we go to UC California and we go to Telegraph Avenue or walking down, you know. I'm one of the people who distracted the bus driver, you know. It's too much always just going straight back to the temple. And then he'd enjoy it, you know. And we had like, I don't know what, ate something, maybe hot dog from a vendor and which anything. And this truck comes by calling for the overthrow of the U.S. government and just, in the most, you know, maybe even the violent overthrow, it stuff that is unimaginable in most other countries, most other countries. And they didn't get arrested. They didn't get, I mean, they might have had FBI watching them or something.
Right.
But what a contrast to Japan, where you had to be very careful what you said and all.
It's kind of like Russia right now. You know, everyone who's criticizing the war in Ukraine
and is going disappearing to jail and dying,
or getting,
going to
getting,
jail,
or jumping out of hospital windows.
Right,
right,
right. And you know. Yeah, so you know, when Suzuki died, there was a guy wrote about him in one of the national newspapers and said, you know, during the years of darkness in Japan, there was silver light coming out of Rinzo Inn. Because people could come and talk and, you know, they wanted the war to end. They didn't talk about wanting Japan to lose the war. They wanted the war to win, to end.
Yeah. And plus he went to Manchuria. So he was obviously part of his social conditioning was, you know, pro Japan to some degree. I mean, like you would.
Totally. Oh yeah. Listen, he thought Japan, Japanese culture, Japanese people were wonderful, but they had just fallen prey to a, like a whole cultish, you know, Japan, the Trump thing in America is worse because people are actually, do they really believe it? They're doing it voluntarily. In Japan, you didn't really have a choice, you know. It was, right. You had to be very careful about not going along with the basically the army, mm-hmm. not the Navy. The army is the ones that instituted. Oh, they brainwashed all the kids, mm-hmm. and so the thing, trip to Manchuria, had nothing to do with the army or mm-hmm. anything. His best friend, Kozo Kato, was in charge of people from his area going over there. And right. Kato was a communist mm-hmm. who was not interested in the imperial system and all that. But he was, you know, sort of high ranking in the government. Mm-hmm. And but he'd have, they didn't trust him. They always had a secret police guy standing outside his door. Mm-hmm. There's kids to go out and play with. But mm-hmm. Suzuki went over to Manchuria, and what he did was they didn't have any priests. There's all these Japanese. He's just going. Mm-hmm. And he had so much to do, he couldn't even go a lot of times to people's homes. They'd just come out in the street. Mm-hmm. And he'd do a memorial service or a blessing prayer, just saying, you know, and just keep going. And then he wanted to start a center there. Mm-hmm. Right. So he was buying into that whole trip, and until the Russians started coming, and then they had to run away and realize they weren't really welcome.
Hey, I have a question about Suzuki in Japan. So here's something I've never really understood. And if you've covered it in the books and I've forgotten, I apologize. So one thing that confuses me about him, his history, is Suzuki seemed to have a pretty sophisticated practice path. You know, he, you know, a lot of people, they just do their quick time at a AAG or Sojiji and then go and inherit the temple. But he had a very sophisticated kind of education. You know, who was the teacher that he was really close with, who wasn't his official teacher?
Kishizawa.
Yeah, like, you would think, like, with his, like, being his, you know, kind of unofficial disciple and stuff, I'm really surprised that Suzuki kind of never rose up in the Soto Shu organization and you know, and gained high ecclesiastical rank.
And yet, no, never.
And like, he kind of wound up, even though he was an intellectual and had a sophisticated practice and like a true practitioner, he kind of wound up as a basically just a temple country priest.
That's like, right.
How did that happen? Like, why did he not?
He wasn't a priest who gave lectures. Mm-hmm. His wife, the one who was murdered, mm-hmm. she said, you know, he didn't speak very well. There's a thing in where he goes to Uchiyama's temple on Taiji, mm-hmm. and meets one time and speaks mm-hmm. in Japanese with Uchiyama's students. And, you know, Uchiyama was Goto Suwaki's Dharma heir and mm-hmm. was the teacher, Shohaku Okumura in Indiana, mm-hmm. so many. Then in the evening or at another time, he met with English speaking. And the ones who went to the Japanese one said, it's just more of the same, sort of boring. Then they go to the English one, they said, oh, now we see. Mm-hmm. He clicked in English. He clicked in America.
So it was just kind of his personality in the Japanese context. He didn't impress, I guess is what it came down to.
No, not at all. They just go, what, him? Yeah. He's in American teaching. He's not qualified to do that.
And he didn't really have the appropriate rank to run a Soto, isn't that right?
I mean, he wouldn't have in Japan, but actually, Rintoin had a Zendo. I don't think if he'd have started something like that, he might not have gotten the right rank, but he could have done it. I mean, you know, Shoto Harada, who was the teacher I studied with, you know, in Sogenji in Okayama, Rinzai, right? lived next door to the temple. He always had, you know, like 20, 25 students. It was a whole big practice thing. Mm-hmm. It never been an official Rinzai Soto, practice place. And he's a Dharmayara of Mumon Yamada, greatest teacher of his time.
It's funny you bring that up. I was just talking to someone who spent a couple years at, I always mess up this pronunciation. Is it Daitakuji or?
Daitakuji.
Daitakuji. Yeah. And he wanted to go actually and practice with Harada. And his teacher said, no, that's not a real Soto. You can't go there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. You got to be careful saying Harada, because there were like four Haradas teaching foreigners.
Please.
Right. That's true. And there were, when I went there first, there were two nuns and two priests who were Japanese, mm-hmm. and they weren't getting credit. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of get credit.
Right.
Toward something, right? Toward having your own temple or being a teacher. They weren't getting credit, and they liked standing with them, but they all ended up leaving because they felt like having all these Westerners around diluted it and made it impossible to practice in the true way, which you do with Japanese. I had Japanese monks talk to me about that. Like, if it's just us, we just do everything together, and everybody, you know, what's the most important is the group and mm-hmm. harmony. Mm-hmm. And if we're with Westerners, we sort of collide because they'll be disagreeing and stuff, and we don't know how to deal with that. So he sort of felt it was good for them to do both. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, Suzuki, one of his goals, one of the things he hoped, was that America and Japan would cross-fertilize each other Zen-wise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that Westerners would go to Japan and help them with anything Japanese was mm-hmm. just completely impossible mm-hmm. for anyone there to consider, except Mumon Yamada. Mm-hmm. He said, like, way back then, Zen's dead in Japan, and the Westerners will come help enliven it again, or something like that.
Yeah, I think I've actually seen a video of him saying that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's on YouTube.
I saw him at Green Gulch when he came. Mm-hmm. Dick, I'll tell you, Dick around Mumon Yamada was like he was with Suzuki. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who he revered above himself.
So actually, that's a good segue. That's the next thing I wanted to talk to you about was, so what's your take of the whole Dick Baker controversy? You're probably tired of talking about it, but as someone who's not, like, some people are very hostile to Dick, and they explain that situation kind of from that perspective, but you seem more comfortable and understanding of him. So I'd kind of like to hear your take on the situation. What's your 1,000-foot view of it?
Oh, Liz Horowitz said she was really angry at Dick. There was some meeting at Zen mm-hmm. Center, and she asked me, and I didn't go to many meetings. You know, I was mm-hmm. living in Bolinas, and mm-hmm. I was doing things for Zen Center with Zen Center, but I had a home in Bolinas with mm-hmm. A wonderful woman who I lived there with 8 years. Mm-hmm. And Liz Horowitz, I was at a meeting at Zen Center that I went to. I remember what I said was, you know, being the abbot of Zen Center, you know, I don't know what I said, but here's, if I said it now, it'd be something like this. I said, if you're the sole abbot of Zen Center, you get this sense of entitlement and everything, and then, you know, you get a lot of power and you can you know, get carried away with it. There's not enough checks and balances, mm-hmm. you know, like in Japan, there's a lot more checks and balances just built into the culture, and then there's society around you judging you. They're very aware of all that. So look, what's going to happen? You're going to get another habit, and the same thing will happen. What you need is a failed habit, somebody that's already been disgraced. And look, we have one right here, Richard Baker. Just keep him as habit and learn how to work with it better. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and afterwards, Liz Horowitz, she just told me this recently. She said, I asked, because I did a podcast with her, and she didn't, she might have told me this in an email or something, but she said, she asked me, how could you support Dick after he did all that? And I said, I have low standards. And she said, when I said that to her, she went, oh, I see. And she said that she was a lot less angry after that.
Do you think there was an overreaction to his transgressions, or do you? Because some people think it was like people are like over puritanical.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. America is basically that way. Man, that people get all freaked out about something sexual. There's a group in America that had a lot of violence and a lot of nasty crap going on, but no sexual indiscretions. Mm-hmm. They've never, you don't even know who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You know? And, you know,
this is Buddha
was asked if there's, which is worse, greed, hate, or delusion, or are they all the same? He said, oh, no. He said, greed is by far a lesser problem. He said, at least you're embracing life. I know. He said the worst is hate or anger. He said, one, you know, one a typical Indian way of writing, one instant, one thought of hate, you know, is worse than an eon of greed. So, I think things got unbalanced, out of hand. People got the impression from reading Shoes Outside the Door and from being around that Dick was, Cruz wrote in the New York Review of Books that women were coming to Zen Center and being assigned to be Dick's concubine. And I wrote them a letter and established who I was, a letter to the editor, you know, saying this is completely untrue. And I had an interview with three very strong, independent women at Zen Center that said, you know, said no, he'd never been inappropriate with them, and that you know they had other problems with him. You know, his thing that made the bubble burst was a weekend affair. That's it. It lasted about 3 days, and yeah, he went crazy. Again, a sense of entitlement. You know, you get so high up in that ivory tower. It was bad. But he told the husband. He's the one who told. Mm-hmm. He went to the husband right away and said, look, here's what happened. And the husband, then he became extremely upset. Anyway, right. I felt that Dick had that one relationship that had gone on for years.
Maybe it was even on your website, but I remember seeing a letter from someone who says, you know, a lot of people say, you know, he took advantage of me and I want to clear the air. You know, I never felt taken advantage of, you know, I went, you know, I was totally consensual, you know, I didn't feel victimized at all. Was that on your website where I came across that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Lucy Bennett. And she said, people are always trying to get her to jump on this bandwagon to, you know, it was, you know, it was bad. They shouldn't have done it. He shouldn't have done it. She shouldn't have done it. You know, you get caught up in your lip. You're living in this bubble, you know, now, and there again, there's not the checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dick's still close with Jenny, who was his wife then. Mm-hmm. He's still close with Lucy. Mm-hmm. And Lucy, you know, but she didn't want to talk about it. She didn't want to. It's just something that happened. And, you know, it's, I was reading, listen, I'm reading, Shane Schoenberg.
Yeah. Are you talking about, Ambivalent Zen?
Yeah, I'm reading his newer book.
Oh, the Shaking or
Four Men Shaking.
Right. Uh huh.
It is really good.
Yeah, Ambivalent. My three favorite Zen memoirs are Ambivalent Zen, Thank You and Okay, and Single Blade of Grass by Henry Shuckman. All of them are Single Blade of Grass. Yeah, they're all excellent.
I should look at. Yeah. I liked Giroux's Two Shores of Zen.
Yes. Yeah, I thought it needed some editing, but it was a little jumpy, but yeah, it was a great book.
Thank You and Okay. I had so many good people working with me. Mm-hmm. It was like a group effort, you know. I just had such good people. Yeah.
Speaking of that book, sorry to interrupt, but I have to ask this before I forget.
Yeah.
In that book, you had a, there was a priest.
Wait, before you said, hold that thought. I just want to complete the thing.
Okay.
Schoenberg
talks about
Edo.
Yeah.
He talks about Edo.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff Edo did is just off the map awful.
Right.
Right. And he talks about incredibly inspiring things Edo had said in talks and how mm-hmm. could this person and his own teacher, Kudo. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, to me, it's like it also involved with this whole cancel culture thing. Look for the good in people. You'll get, if you dismiss people because of the bad things they've done, you're going to miss out on a lot. Mm-hmm. And look for the good in people. And that is also perennial philosophy. It's not just my way of looking at it. It's what wise people have said through the years, and that mm-hmm. judgment, you know who Satan is? Satan's the accuser.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, enough on that. Now your turn.
Yeah, sorry. and I apologize for interrupting. I know I'd forget to ask if I don't do it now. So and Thank You and Okay, you talk about a priest who like went up in the tree when a Katagiri, yeah. Was it Katagiri?
No, it's Nonin.
Oh, it was him. Okay. I always wondered who that was. Yeah, okay.
Norman.
Okay.
Yeah. That's actually one thing in the book I made up.
Oh, really?
It's a tribute to Catch 22.
I didn't get that.
With Yossarian in the tree. The Yossarian, come down.
Oh, interesting. I feel duped. Right?
I'm not coming down till so and so. I can't remember what. So, yeah, but, that might be the only thing in the book I made up. Uh-huh. But I just thought that would be cool. Incidentally, Nonin went over the book. Of course, I changed all these names. I changed the places. Mm-hmm. I changed everything. I changed where they were mm-hmm. Because I didn't know if they'd wanted it or anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I kept Dick's name and Suzuki's name and Katagiri's name, mm-hmm. my name, my wife's name. Nonin went over, I sent him the book and he went over it twice. He said he cried through the second half both times. Mm-hmm. He said I had an incredibly good memory. He wouldn't change a thing. Mm-hmm. And he'll be very careful what he says to me in the future.
That's funny.
But that was, I didn't realize that. And then I had some people angry about very minor things. I said, I learned something. I had three people angry. Mm-hmm.
It's been a really long time since I read that book. Who was the Rinzai master you studied with? That was that Shoto Harada?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was that experience like for you after so many years of Soto?
I loved it. It was great. I just like him so much, and I really enjoyed it, and he was so understanding. And we had a really good relationship, and he was like our sponsor, man. We were there because of him. He got us a house next door for like $350 a month, with a garden by the beautiful mountain paths next to the temple. We're paying the amount people are paying for little one room places by the train station. He was always good. He was always helpful. That guy, and Japanese priests in general, they know, they do it in a way that very, very few Americans can. They just really devote themselves to it. I mean, he is just completely with his students. All that he's got, and you know, Hojo-san, it means like some space that's very small. And Hojo-san's what you call the abbot. The chief priest of temples. People have a temple. They're all Hojo-san. So he's called Hojo-san there. And that comes from the like something that's about 10 square feet or something. That's what the abbot gets. It probably goes back to some story about, you know, from India. In fact, I probably used to know where it came from. He just had these two little rooms, and they're just full of books and stuff. I don't know if anybody, I mean, he would have cleaned it, you know. And I'd talk to him and come there with sewing, you know, mending something. He's just always there. He's always with the students or doing sesshin or something else. And he was always thoughtful. He did not like the Rinzai trip with being mean and yelling and screaming and beating people and all that, which was pretty severe in a lot of places. He kicked the head monk out for hitting somebody.
Do you know who that was by chance?
Yeah, I know who that was.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Wonder.
We'll talk about it afterward.
It was an American.
Yeah.
But he also kicked a Japanese priest out for slapping a nun. He has a quality that Suzuki had, is listening and learning from people, which is not the norm. You know, listening and learning from students, from visitors. And I saw him change. He had some ideas that I thought were sort of not right, historical or
like right-wing views and stuff, you mean?
Yeah. They keep stuff out of history books and the newspapers that makes them look bad. Japan in general. It's also there, but if you're not making an attempt, right? But anyway, I saw that all change. And, you know, but basically he's interested in the Dharma and in teaching. I mean, that stuff doesn't matter in the long run.
So he was... he's known to be famously intense in Dokusan. Was he that way with you?
Yeah, I describe it. Thank you. Okay. But, you know, I told him when I first met him, I can't be like your students. I told him when I first met him that I was a Zen failure. I mean, that's where it came from. But I'm going around looking for stuff. But then I came back a few months later. And I said, look, I've been everywhere, and this is the place I'm going to be. But I can't. I can't. I'd like to live in the area with my wife. We weren't married yet, but that I didn't want to test his challenge his open-mindedness that far. I call it like America in the 50s or the 40s. I said, I just like to live in the neighborhood and come here a few times a week and sit and have a relationship with you. But I'm not like your students. I can't be like that. I said, you know, I'm a Zen burnout, you know. Mm-hmm. He went, that's okay. You're PhD level. So he always, you know, with Jap. And another thing is I did what I said I was going to do. See, I gave low expectations. There was another guy who'd been there before me from mm-hmm. America who said he wanted to sit every sitting and do every session and everything. And then he didn't. Mm-hmm. So Arata was always a little pissed at him mm-hmm. and didn't respect him for that. Mm-hmm. I said, I underplayed what I could do. Mm-hmm. So he was always, he said, well, you're busy, you know, you're teaching. It's amazing mm-hmm. you can make it here at all. And he was always understanding.
I don't remember, did you do Sesshin with him there?
No, I never did a Sesshin there. Mm-hmm. I've done Sesshin, I could have, mm-hmm. but I was just lazy. I was happy just to sit.
Mm-hmm. Did he have you working on Mu?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I never passed Mu. I mean, he'd said, well, you pretty much got it, but not really. Yeah. But I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. yeah, that was... I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being with him. I've seen him in America when he's come back, mm-hmm. you know, gone and listened to a talk. And
So for those who have not read that book, could you tell people what your experience was with the Japanese and brown rice and incense?
Oh, brown rice. Oh, incense. Yeah. Brown rice. We ate brown rice. And you can get brown rice. So some people are buying it.
Yeah.
But there was a rice store near us mm-hmm. where they get brown rice and they make the white rice. But in Japan, you have a choice. There's a machine that the white rice has to go through, I think, 10 times mm-hmm. to get the
polish it.
Hull off. Mm-hmm. There's the husk. Nobody eats the husk. And there's the hull. The rice with the hull on it is brown rice. Mm-hmm. So that's speaking Indonesian. Let's see. That's number 10. We would get sometimes number 7. I think it was Nanabazuki. like it had gone through 3 times and had a little bit taken on. Bob Halpern turned me on to that. Mm-hmm. And I think most Japanese would get, you know, like 1 or 2 or 3, you know, mm-hmm. like that. But they might just buy it in bags at the store. But this was a place that received the actual rice and did it. Mm-hmm. So I think we got into, I might be wrong. I mean, it's been 30 years, but I think it might have been Nanabazuki we call mm-hmm. with Nana's 7. And then Bazuki would be a counter or something. I don't know. All right. But I'd say to people that we eat brown rice and they go, oh, brown rice. Yeah. Very, very healthy. Not tasty, but very healthy. And they always say that. Right.
Yeah.
What was the other one?
Oh, incense. Their reaction to you burning.
Oh, incense. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, we had people coming in for English class. And, you know, I had a really good adult class. And some of them were rather outspoken, which was nice and unusual. So the guy... who owned that liquor store. I don't know what anybody's real names were anymore mm-hmm. because I just know what I called him in the book. Mm-hmm. I think I called him Shimizu. He comes in, he goes, oh God, what's that awful smell? I said, incense? He says, yeah, why are you burning incense? What are we doing? And then more of my adult students come in and go, oh, it's that awful smell. So to them, incense is what you have at funerals and memorial services.
Yeah. So,
you know, Zen, people don't like Buddhism there. They like Shinto. Shinto does births. Shinto does weddings. Shinto blesses babies. You got a new baby, you take it to the shrine. Buddhism, that's for funerals and memorial services. Getting married, I think I said, I've seen it somewhere recently, so probably in the book, getting married in a Buddhist temple would be like getting married in a funeral home.
So how did you come to write Crooked Cucumber? Did you always know you wanted to write?
No, no. I want to say one other thing about
Okay.
One reason Japan's culture is so strong and is held together so well, same as here, is it's rooted in animism, in Shinto. Mm-hmm. And so then it has the Buddhism on top, right? Here I can say that people's hearts are really with the animism. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism is more intellectual, you know, they're Hindu, same thing. And then they always say, but there's only one God. That's because it's Indonesia. It's a Muslim country. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something they said to stay out of trouble. Mm-hmm. But yeah, go on.
So how did you come to write Cucumber?
Crooked Cucumber. Well, I did not have an idea. Right now, looking back, I remember I took stuff, I mentioned this, about Suzuki. I started taking it out of Thank You and Okay, because I was thinking, I should focus on Katakiri, and maybe Suzuki stuff could be for something later. But it still wasn't a strong idea of a book. Maybe I did. Yeah, I guess I started developing it then. It'd be neat to do something on Suzuki. And that just developed slowly. Mm-hmm. And then when we went back to America, we went to Santa Fe for a year because I wanted to work on Thank You. I didn't want to be in the Bay Area. I knew too many people. Mm-hmm. And I'd have more obligations. Actually, it turned out I knew too many people in Santa Fe area too, you know. Mm-hmm. There are all these people from the Zen Center realm. And I'd already been visiting people in Santa Fe on my way, and Taos on my way back and forth from California to Texas. So I started interviewing people in 93 for the book. And mm-hmm. I didn't finish Thank You and Okay until the end of 93. It came out in 94. Can't remember what month. I went over it for the last time at Rinso Inn while I was interviewing people for Crooked Cucumber. Uh-huh. So it's just natural. You do one book and it sort of leads to another. Although Michael told me I was the only writer he represented who didn't immediately have a proposal for another book when the first book was through. Mm-hmm. And I haven't, you know, I've written a lot, put a lot of stuff on my website, but I've focused more on the oral written history and, mm-hmm. you know, the websites and stuff. And I wrote a novel, To Find the Girl from Perth. And I illustrated it and made a CD of 26 songs to go along with it. And they're all in it. And I made an audio book. It's actually on some stuff. It's on YouTube and a few places. But now I've gone over it again here. And very soon, maybe later this month, I will make it available on Audible if they'll take it. Mm-hmm. I made it in 2009, and my voice was better then, and I made so many fewer mistakes. But you know, I'm 77 now, so it's like stumbling, and then I have to go back and sort of fix everything.
So Suzuki's children were not that excited about the book, it sounds like. Did you?
No, they were by then.
Okay.
They learned a lot while I was making it. They went through things like his daughter, his oldest daughter, what's her name? Maybe Yasuko. She cried, you know, talking to me about it. And she said she'd never cried before. Yeah, the whole thing. And the relationship was Zen-centered, even more so, I'd say.
Did they push back at all?
No.
They were open to it.
Yeah, they were helpful. Well, actually, at first, Oichi was totally into my father, wasn't a great man. I'm not going to help you glorify my father. And but after a while, you know, he already knew me. He should have known better. And then, you know, we sat up drinking one night and we talked about that. And that convinced him that wasn't where I was coming from. But he'd already spent 2 days refusing to do anything for him. He made me help him with a 10-run guy, an exhibition of his calligraphy, and help him with that whole thing. But finally, that got through to him. And then he started making things work. And I was there like 10 days or something. So he really got me together a lot. He got totally into it. He's always been supportive of that because I did not promote unfounded glorification. And, you know.
Did you know about his wife being murdered before you started writing that book? Because I had never heard anything about that.
That was known by a few people. I think I might have heard it. Dick knew about it. Mayumi knew about it. People in Japan knew about it, I can tell you that. But they're not blabbermouths.
Yeah.
I mean, the Japanese felt, and there was gossip in America among Japanese, that the reason he came to America was to escape the shame of his wife having been murdered. And people said that in Japan, priests would say. Brian Victoria's teacher told him that. But maybe that was who it was. You know, I don't have to know all these details anymore. It's really not important, you know. The teaching's what's important, but it's fun. And we've got to have fun things or, you know, get sort of drab. I can't remember when I really knew. It went sort of, I think it went from something, I guess I had heard, but at some point I really knew. I could have looked for that guy, guy who murdered his wife, and I did not consider it seriously. The family would have been pissed about that.
Yeah.
I did interview people they didn't want me to interview. They wanted to totally control it, and I just went out and met neighbors. And one of them was so important, and they didn't want me to talk to him because he was politically involved with a controversial, you know, politics. He was probably, you know, in favor of change that was, you know, they want harmony. That's all. Yeah. My German grandparents were like the German-American grandparents. They just wanted harmony. They didn't want anything to rock the boat or anything to hurt your reputation.
The Japanese mentor of Suzuki, I forgot his name earlier. I forgot again.
Kishizawa.
Yeah, he's the one who pushed Suzuki to have that crazy monk at the temple. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Do you think he felt culpable at all?
Huh?
Do you think he felt culpable at all for that, or any remorse?
I don't know what he felt.
but I guess, did you encounter anybody talking about, like, was he apologetic or was he?
Oh, no, they wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do. You know, they're very formal. And he and Kishizawa, who knows? They deal with set phrases, you know, most things like that. There's set phrases for expressing things, and they're not like us. They don't pour their heart out and stuff like that. In certain circumstances, they will. I mean, it's
get them drinking. But
yeah, drinking, you can do anything, or at least you used to be able to. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It used to be. Well, yeah, he had an accident and he hit somebody, but he was drunk, you know, so he's not guilty. It went from that to zero tolerance. Any they do breathalyzers, and I did drive some the last year, and I didn't drink a lot then, and I didn't drink when I drove because this will happen. Doing a breathalyzer test, if you got any alcohol, they'll arrest you. It's not like 0.07 or whatever. Incidentally, I finally stopped 18 years ago. That was a good choice.
So your audiobook of Crooked Cucumber. So I'm going through that right now. I'm about probably 2/3 of the way through it. I mostly listen to it when I go on long road trips. I really like that you actually cry and laugh during the book. I think it really adds to it. Did you get any pushback from the publishers on that?
No, they didn't listen to it.
Okay.
You know, I was just writing. I wrote an email. I'm pretty close with them, with the president of Shambhala and the woman in charge of that. I said, you know, the audiobooks and your ebooks are not getting the scrutiny that your printed books do. So, for instance, there's problems more with the presentation things. So, do you use the navigation on Crooked Cucumber? Do you go back to another?
I use the
Audible. Are you just going straight through?
Just linearly straight through.
My navigation doesn't work. I'll click on chapter 7, it'll be chapter 8, or it might start in the middle of something else.
Yeah, I haven't got that.
And the book went up originally. It had one problem, had to be taken off. And then it had another problem that I discovered, but surely my fault, is that it had chapter 8 where chapter 3 should be. There was no chapter 3, so it had to be taken off again and make sure it's right. And you do a print book, there's people on it. There's editor, there's copy editors, and also on those two books, I spent thousands and thousands of dollars of my own people going over it, so that I didn't even depend on them. Audiobook man, it's just me. I did have Bill Redican going over it.
Do you like literally up? Do you upload the files yourself?
Oh yeah,
I
produce it, everything.
It's crazy.
But Bill Redican went over, like, my first take on Crooked Cucumber. He went, oh God, that guy is fastidious. I mean, and giving me notes and background and suggestions. And so many things. So I fixed all that. And then I went over it again and I found many more things. And
obviously sometimes you'll be like, and then he walked over to the, you know, like, it's obvious that you dubbed in like a mistaken word, and you know what I mean? Like, you edited in.
Yeah. I'm doing a lot better now.
Yeah.
I don't think you can tell where I do it now.
Yeah. But you know, it almost adds to like the charm of it in a way, you know?
To me, it's barely, Actually, when I listen to it, it sounds all right. I don't listen to it for fun. I'll go back for some reason for it. I think, but that's not so bad. But to me, the whole thing is subpar. I have a much better microphone now. I have the same microphone Joe Rogan uses for, you know, is making hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. He's the COVID expert, right?
Yeah, right. The microphone, incidentally, was bought for me by a generous donor who bought me a new computer and more than that, studio speakers. And, that's really, really helped. I've just learned a lot. I've learned a lot. I would much rather have an engineer and do it with somebody, have them go over it and fix it, but I don't. I have to do it all myself. And I could get a lot more done if I had people like that working for me, like Joe Rogan and some, you know.
I really like it. I mean, because it almost feels more like you're listening to a podcast or hearing a friend talk than an audio.
Yeah. Book.
You know, I have no complaints. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm the only person Shambhala has had do their own. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't know what to do at first. Yeah. But I really feel that Peter Ford's, I call him the managing director of Duke Archives. Mm-hmm. He's really more on the overall and Suzuki.com. He's just always, he's been doing it for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And I say I'm on special projects. I work on the overall too. Mm-hmm. But he's more together. And I tend to be sort of, I'm sort of like having some stumbling drunk in doing it, although I don't drink. Anyway, he went over, Thank You and Okay, Crooked Cucumber has like 19 chapters. Thank You and Okay has 89. Mm-hmm. That's including the introduction and the outgoing thing. But I asked him to go over it all. Listen to the beginning, very beginning, first minute, or so, make sure that's all correct, make sure the end is correct. And he found some mistakes in that. I went over a lot, but I think it's good. I hope so.
Cool. Looking forward to it. So, so we're pushing 2 hours here, but I wanted to ask you.
All right, right. I want to say one other thing about the laughing and crying.
Sorry.
That's edited too. I laughed a lot more than that. I had to get a sense in both books of how far to go. In some of this emotional stuff in Crooked Cucumber, there would be, I couldn't talk. There'd be a space of 30 seconds. I'm waiting till I can talk. I mean, I don't want to be just breaking down when I'm doing. So I left in where you can sort of see it and experience it. But I just left you some of it. And Thank You and Okay, I'm laughing all the time. Yeah, I can't remember what I said. It's like reading somebody else.
Right. Yeah, really adds to it. I'm glad you left that in. That's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so as I was saying, like, we're pushing 2 hours. But before we go, I wanted to ask you, like, what brought you to Bali, of all places?
Well, I spent the last few months of my mother's life with her, which was an inspiring experience. Mm-hmm. She did. I have a section on Cuke.com called Santhara about not eating and drinking at the end of life, not eating, and then at the very end, stopping liquids, as I call it, the natural, traditional way of death with dignity. Mm-hmm. And that's what she did. Of course, she knew about it because I'd written about it. And I remember when I first talked to her about it years ago, she said, "But that's terrible, David." She said, "Well, wait a minute. I have two friends that have done that." Mm-hmm. And then she started thinking about it. I said, you get the liquid out of your body and it lowers pain. Mm-hmm. It's And I said, that's what the hospice people are into. And I need, but anyway, so I stayed with her. She didn't eat for 2 months. Mm-hmm. And then she didn't drink the last 9 days, which is an exceptionally long time. I was with Claude Dallenberg. He did that. And he died the fifth day after not drinking. So anyway, and she didn't complain. She didn't take any medicine. So that was very inspiring. And then I had to go through things, and my sister came, Katrinka came, had to, you know, sell the home, sell the piano, very nice piano, stuff like that. It took months, right? Mm-hmm. And so then I had her car then, nice car, a Camry, my second Camry. Mm-hmm. So that's it. I closed up Fort Worth and drove back. Katrinka was taking care of her second husband, who was in a convalescent home. Mm-hmm. And then he died. We had a little money. And I said, you know, this money will last a lot longer if we go to Asia. Mm-hmm. So we flew to Singapore. And we only had tickets, Singapore, Thailand, Japan, Singapore. Back to America. And so let's take a side trip to Bali. You know, I was there 30 years ago. So back then it would have been, I was there 21 years ago. And we liked it. And then we spent 6 weeks in Thailand and 10 weeks in Japan. And especially in Japan, there was a ton of things to do, a ton of people to do. We had an apartment in Kyoto. And I have friends there, and it was great. We loved it. Great place to walk. Uh-huh. Oh, so great. But we realized Bali's where we want to be. It's so user-friendly. Uh-huh. You know, it's so mellow. It's really nice. And it's cheaper than Thailand.
The weather's nice.
Actually, yeah, you know, it's not bad. We live near the ocean. You know, it gets hot here, but I mean, this is the coolest time. We're just coming out of the coolest time of the year. Uh-huh. I never had to wear a long sleeve shirt, but it was nice. Sometimes if you go down to the beach at night when it's windy in August, you might want a long sleeve shirt. But there's higher places here, higher altitude. You better bring a sweater if you go there.
How's the food?
Well, there's all sorts of Indonesian and Balinese food. You can live and eat very cheaply. There's all sorts of ways you can eat. You can eat where there's too much oil or without it. But another thing is, I don't know how many expats there are here, but there are a lot, you know, 20,000, I don't know, 50,000. It's like we have organic produce delivered, and delivery's cheap here. Labor's cheap. We have organic produce. Like we get like Whole Foods quality food here. So you don't have everything, but you have, you know, a choice of Japanese restaurants and Italian restaurants and French restaurants. And that's here. I mean, this isn't even over in Kuta and Seminyak, which is more like being in New York than here. We're in Sanur. So it's very pleasant. It's getting more expensive. I don't know what we're going to do. We've got our rent paid up for 2 years. If I don't buy a lot of rent right now, I think we won't be able to afford to stay here where we are. Mm-hmm. It's just the prices are just zooming up. However, climate change might make it zoom back down again. We'll see.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So is there anything you want to talk about that we didn't cover before we sign off here?
Oh, no, I'll think about that after we've hung out.
All right.
That's called the spirit of the stairs.
Yeah, we'll do part two.
Part two. You know about the spirit of the stairs?
No.
It's a French saying, so it's in French. That's when, you come from a party and, you were talking to some people about something and you wished you didn't know what to say. And then you're walking up the stairs to home and you go, oh, that's what I should have said.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or for me, I'd be like, why did I say that?
Oh, yeah.
I'd do that one.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Indeed.
Because I have a pretty dry sense of humor. And sometimes, I'll say something that, oh, this will be really funny. And then later I'll think, oh, that probably made me sound like a jerk. Like that.
I think most of us, I'd see things we regret are much stronger, more strongly embedded in memory. And I think how minor my regrets are and how major so many people have. I think, oh God, how did they live with that? And then I think, well, that must be why so many soldiers commit suicide.
Yeah. Was it Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss? I think you've definitely lived your life that way.
Yeah, I was raised on that. Mm-hmm. You know, The Secret? That movie, The Secret?
No. Never saw it.
It's the whole New Age thing. You create your own reality, and then it's all mind. That's what I was raised on. Mm-hmm. It was no secret in our home.
Yeah.
But you have to apply it wisely. You can't have a one-sided understanding of things, mm-hmm. The Secret, it to me is sort of arrogant and mm-hmm. doesn't see a bigger picture. I like Suzuki saying, ride the wave, drive the wave. So The Secret sort of like drive the wave, but mm-hmm. it's missing ride the wave.
You know, Kokio Hinkle, the San Francisco Zen Center priest.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, he kind of lives his life that way, just take it day by day and things just kind of work out. And, I really admire people who live that way.
Yeah. But we'll see how it goes. One good thing about living here is I can concentrate on work. Mm-hmm. I work a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm always just trying to get done what I'm doing. See, I'm dying to get back to Tatsara Stories. So I've set a date, October 1st. There's some things I need to get done, get them out of the way. And then it's always that way. And I'm always behind. And new things come up.
Is that going to be a print book and an audiobook or just an audiobook?
Who knows?
Okay.
Who knows? I mean, probably Shambhala would be more interested in another book of vignettes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it'll definitely be an audiobook. Hey, I got the audiobook rights to Crooked Cucumber mm-hmm. from Random House as a gift from the parting editor in Roma, because I'd asked him about audiovisual. My reason why I hadn't thought about doing an audiobook, it was way back before that was on the map so much. I wanted to be able to stop a movie. And I have had people contact me about movie. And I think the Japan part could be done, but the American part, I wouldn't want it done. It couldn't be done. I don't know. I just can't. Who can't be done? Maybe if.
The scene where you were goofing off at Tassajara and they had a meeting in Suzuki Roshi's cabin and the guy was hoping to get you in trouble, and that'd be a good movie scene.
Yeah.
You know talking about?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was something. Yeah, that is I mean, one thing, right? I was hung over. Mm-hmm. And I'd been up with guests. I don't know why. I usually would be late because of studying. I studied ridiculously long hours there and worked on things. And I studied with Suzuki, you know, stuff in Chinese and Japanese. Reading the Chinese, is, you can just read it, you know, if you know, like I could read Dogen and stuff. Not well, not like the people that went on to become scholar, but he was very encouraging. And I'd tell him, I'd say, hey, I stayed up all night again studying. And Miss Zuz, and he'd say, yeah, keep it up. He'd say, people think you're crazy, but go on and keep it up. But he knew he could trust me not to tell people. Oh, he told me. Suzuki, Roshi said I could, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
So he knew when it was Nils, my dear friend Nils, who I miss, who was Suzuki Roshi, what do you think about a student that breaks the rules? You know, I was sitting, I had just gotten up for the tea. I didn't do that much, but you know, and I was just like really hungover and probably smelled, you know. And what do you think about a student who breaks the rules? He said, well, you can break the rules and still keep the spirit of the rules. And I went, thank you, Jesus. And then he went, but you know, he pursued it a little, then finally went, but Roshi, can't you follow the rules and have the spirit? And Suzuki said, yes, that's the best way. But see, when he did that, he knew, I knew, he wasn't telling me what I did was okay. Uh-huh. You know, and he knew that I would, you know, try not to do that again or be cool. Uh-huh. Even Dick Baker used to tell me, you know, just, you know, what you did, so-and-so, it's okay, really, your practice is good, but people don't know it, it looks bad, you know? You kind of want you out about that sort of thing. So, you know, it just helps to get older, you know? My baby is pretty good now, 77.
Actually, let me ask you one more question. I'm curious, I don't know how closely you follow, you know, the day-to-day of San Francisco Zen Center. I'm curious, like, in what ways, like, if you could sum it up, do you think it's still basically the same place, or do you think it's a drastically different organization? Obviously, it's more, you know, checks and balances, and it's different in that respect. But yeah, as far as culture and feel and, you know, and energy, do you think it's changed significantly, or is it largely
the same? Well, it evolves. See, when I tell people who complain about, like, it's been really into a reactive mode or something to all the PC stuff, and especially wanting to make it a safe place. To me, the idea of a temple being a safe place is interesting. I agree, it should be safe in some ways, but not mentally safe. You shouldn't, your identity, sense of identity shouldn't be safe there, you know? So I see some of that stuff, then sort of kowtowing to the all the PC wins. But you know, when I tell people, I say, well, you know, it evolves, don't worry, you know, since it goes through phases, and you know, they're just trying to hold it together, and they're trying to respond to what the social pressures of the times. So I just, you know, there's financial pressures, there's climate change has really hurt Tassajara. Right. Tassajara's in trouble. You know, there's like not enough water to fight fires, and not enough water in the creek. Or, you know, that's one of its big draws. And the whole thing's been, but listen, I was at a meeting in 2008. They have a thing called the, with all the guests, all the friends, important friends and donors to Zen Center, a number are invited to a thing called the No Race. It's like it's the opening of the guest season in May, and maybe on May Day, which used to be an American holiday for workers, and but isn't anymore. I think because it's too associated with communists. So now we've just got Labor Day. Anyway, Steve Stuckey was Abbott and Paul Haller, and they were there presenting the 10-year plan for Zen Center to this selected group. And Katrinka and I were invited to be there, which we usually weren't, but I think they needed to fill a space or something. And I knew a lot of these, I probably knew more of the donors and board people than anybody else, you know? And so there, one thing I didn't particularly like that, I thought, I don't think the abbots should be doing PR for Zen Center, raising money. So I guess that's one of their roles. But I asked a question, I was there, Tony, I said, have you, 2008, have you calculated in anything about climate change? Because I was into climate change in 2008. Mm-hmm. No. And so to me, Zen Center, you know, follows a lot of the same sorts of maybe somewhat predictable trends that institutions in general do. Mm-hmm. So there tends, we'll see how well they adjust to changing times. We could have some pretty extreme things happening, but we'll see. We really don't know. What was it? Somebody said it's in Larry Sheinberg. What's his name?
Sheinberg, I think.
Who said? Maybe it was Edo told him. I think it was him. Anyway, I read it yesterday. Said the best advice he ever got was expect nothing. You know, or don't be so sure of what you think is going to be happening. Even Lovelock said that, the guy who did Gaia, the Revenge of Gaia, Rough Ride into the Future, just died at 103. Mm-hmm. He says he thinks that the biosphere is in the last 1% of its life. And he said maybe we'll have I think he felt like the best case scenario was an 80% die off of human beings. Mm-hmm. He said, but we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know.
World's changing.
Yeah. We started off before you were recording on talking about climate change.
Right.
Yeah. And probably you should cut it off here. You don't want it to be too long.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Let's.
Hey, tell me. All right. Say goodbye, and then I want to talk to you a minute.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been good. I enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you.